record high temperature for this time of year at 122 degrees. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 85 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 80 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, June 7, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on the beginning of Pride Month by going to El Salvador to discuss the challenges faced by the country's LGBTQ community in the face of growing authoritarianism under Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele. This June 1st not only marks the beginning of Pride Month in the U.S., but also marks the beginning of Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele's second term in office. A term that violates the Salvadoran Constitution that strictly forbids second presidential terms and marks another step backwards in the country's backsliding democracy. The Bukele administration has also cast doubt on the democratic future of the country in a variety of ways, from civil rights to freedom of speech and everything in between. Bukele's illegal inauguration also included American right-wing luminaries like Donald Trump Jr., former Fox host Tucker Carlson, and Florida Representative Matt Gaetz, among others. But on today's show, we'll discuss how his brand of authoritarianism has affected El Salvador's LGBTQ community and how these challenges should matter to the rest of the Salvadoran diaspora. And so today on the show, we are joined by Nicola Chavez, who's the head of historical memory for AMATE in El Salvador. She joins us from El Salvador. Welcome to the show, Nicola Chavez.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
We're also joined today by Roberto Zapata, who's also a member of AMATE de El Salvador. He actually joins us today from Argentina. Welcome to the show, Roberto Zapata.
for everyone, and thank you for having me as well.
Absolutely, you got it. So certainly there's a lot to discuss this week alone as it pertains to the democratic future of El Salvador. Like I said before, a lot of right-wing luminaries went to his illegal inauguration to show support to this authoritarian direction that he's taking the country. But before we get to all those issues, before we get in depth on the Bukele administration's assault on LGBTQ rights, Nicola, can you tell us about your organization, Amate de Salvador? What are you guys about? What do you guys do? And tell us, you know, how it fits into the context of what we'll be discussing here.
I am one of the founders of the organization. We started getting together in 2013 and kind of seeing this need for documentation of what was happening with the LGBTQ movement. You know, at the time, President Mauricio Funes is in power. We have a Secretariat of Sexual Diversity in government. So there's greater visibility, greater opportunities to a certain extent. And yet every day, LGBTQ Salvadorans are still pretty dire in regards to access to economic and educational and all sorts of other opportunities, which, you know, implies all sorts of different kinds of threats to your well-being, right? Like if you can't afford to eat, you can't afford to stay in the country, right? That's, you know, and all this is happening because either you are or are perceived to be, you know, trans or gay or non-binary. And so basically we got kind of, you know, gently called in by trans women leaders saying, you know, you need to start documenting what's happening here because we're too busy fighting for our lives. Like, you know, you people who can kind of get along like passing a cis or don't have to sort of deal with the heaviest of brunts, right? Folks like us who like generally are, you know, college educated, like da 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 da. So it started, I would say, as like a historical memory project, which is kind of, you know, why I've stuck around for so long to make sure that there is like continuity to queer and trans people's presence in the Salvadoran historical record, because it's, you know, a history that isn't really discussed or documented. And I think, you know, at this point in a really like historically revisionist context, like the one that we're living in is like being actively erased, right? And, you know, really beautifully, thanks to people like Roberto and others, it's morphed into like this like much bigger kind of leftist feminist project, queer and trans project that does a lot of work with, for example, youth organizing, anti-fascist organizing, labor and union organizing in a way that I think is both bringing queer and trans issues to the table for sort of, you know, quote unquote, regular social movements, right? You know, people who are focusing on things like access to water and corruption or whatever, and maybe not thinking like, oh, hey, we should reach out to, you know, the trans collectives to be a part of our civil society platform as well. And why it would be important to do so, you know, seeing as how like we're also Salvadorans that are affected by water scarcity. We live here too, right? And I think also bringing some of these broader issues into the LGBTQ movement when folks may not be thinking about them as queer or trans issues in general. I think labor is like a really big one, for example, right? You know, what I was mentioning in regards to there being very little protections or safeguards for people's access to education and employment, et cetera. Obviously, if you're a trans person who has to rely on sex work as your only means of income because you weren't able to finish high school, because you weren't able to get a job in your field, all of these things because you don't pass, that's a workers' rights issue, right? As much as it is a trans issue as well.
One other thing that I think is important to mention is that since the beginning, one of the things that we thought it was a good point for Amate to work on was to organize people where people were not organized. So for example, we thought about decentralizing the movement from San Salvador because historically it has been like mostly the majority of the organizations have been located in San Salvador. So we wanted to, you know, help the organization of other LGBT communities in other parts of the country. We started doing this field work in the eastern side of the country, let's say like small cities, but mostly in San Miguel. And in 2021, we finally were able to create this location. This is a space where other, let's say, LGBTI groups can meet and start, you know, organizing towards a cause that they didn't have the option previously, because Even though, for example, San Miguel is like second city in the country, there weren't any organizations, at least LGBTI organizations there. And there were some initiatives, but they were like very small scale and also without any resources. So one of the works that we have been able to do is to strengthen their work, what they are doing, and also training their capabilities as to be to have more advocacy and more capabilities in general to organize more people. Because, you know, we are living times where people is scared of organizing at all. And yes, for LGBTI people, it's even more difficult to organize because there is, you know, the authoritarian government on one side, but there's the, like the, you know, historical discrimination and violence against sexual diversity. So it's a challenge, but I have to say that we have found a lot of potential in these territories where previously the work through LGBTI organizations was very limited. And one other thing that is, you know, and Nicola already mentioned, is to bring together different sectors of social movements to work, you know, in a more intersectional agenda and not just like, let's say, disaggregated from the rest. So we really wanted the LGBTI community to be able to see the link between our specific demands with the general popular demands and also the other sectors of the popular movements to see the link that we have with them. So this is a challenge also because there's these cultural differences that we have, let's say, in terms of what some people believe is like the priority in terms of what we should be demanding in certain periods. But at the same time, we are seeing, let's say, a little bit of more openness from youth to see this work coming together.
So both you and Nicola have already hit on two things that we've done over the course of the last few years on the Latino Media Collective, especially during the Bukele years. And that's hit on two underlying issues with regards to the backsliding democracy in the country. One is fear, and two is the erasure of history or the erasure of memory. And that's sort of underlying everything in Salvadoran society, including LGBTQ rights. So Roberto, I'll start with you with the next question. As of June 1st marks the beginning of Bukele's illegal second term. I cannot stress that enough. Illegal second term as the president of the country. What does it mean to the LGBTQ community? And what challenges has the community faced during Bukele's first term, especially during the state of exception, Roberto?
Well, what does it mean? I think it means more bitter medicine for groups, well, for the working class in general, but more specifically for the groups in vulnerability within this working class. The LGBTI community, of course, is between those sectors more affected. Since the beginning of this, well, of the previous administration, let's say the constitutional administration, and now with the unconstitutional administration, we believe that we will continue to see the deterioration of the rights of the LGBTI community. Previously, before, and Nicola already mentioned, we had this social inclusion secretariat, which was part of the presidency of El Salvador. And it had direction of sexual diversity that worked to train or sensitize public institutions to be more inclusive for LGBTI community. It wasn't perfect, but it was something that it was, you know, an actual unit from the government working specifically for the LGBTI people. And it was something that we at the organizations knew that if we encounter any type of problem in certain institution, or if it was a discrimination case or whatever, we could go to this institution and they could work out something. Then when Bukele took office in 2019, this was one of the institutions that got eliminated. And it was a big backstep for us. And we denounced it back then. But then the government said that, say, the functions that this direction had was going to be part of the cultural ministry. And they really didn't work that out really well. And because in general, let's say the Ministry of Culture doesn't have much resources and it doesn't have like the capabilities to do the same work that it had previously with the Social Inclusion Secretariat. First of all, it was only like two people working in one unit, which had the gender demands on one side, which is more for like women binary, you know, in a binary sense. And then you have the sexual diversity demands. And of course, they just didn't have enough resources to work. Even after the years pass and they tried to do something, still they couldn't get to the same point where we were back in 2019. But that's on one side. But on the other side, the government, we were able to see like all other things happening at the same time. Like, for example, other backsteps in terms of the gender identity law that has been one of the main priorities for the LGBTI movement and specifically for trans people since 2010, but in 2018, they were able to proceed with a project into the legislative assembly. Unfortunately, the new legislative assembly with big majority of Nuevas Ideas party didn't continue with the discussion of this law.
So just to support your point, PBS did a report on this in May of last year with reference to what you just mentioned, which is the government dissolving the Ministry of Social Inclusion, which conducted training on gender identity and investigate LGBTQ issues nationwide. In addition to that, in 2022, the country's Supreme Court determined that the inability of a person to change their name because of gender identity constituted discriminatory treatment. Despite these rulings, pretty much the National Assembly allowed the deadlines to enforce these rules to expire months afterwards. So yes, it's a backsliding democracy, not just because of direct action, but just a plain old ignoring the law altogether, correct?
Totally. The court gave the Legislative Assembly 1 year to legislate this with a gender identity law, and they just didn't do anything. In fact, I think that what we have seen in the Legislative Assembly is more and more hate discourse against the LGBTI community coming from different deputies, specifically from the Nuevas Ideas party. And this is like replicated with the propaganda machine that they have in different media platforms. And also, you know, people from like YouTube and other social media. And this is something that it has been increasing over time, and it comes like directly from like people with big platforms that are, you know, political profiles of the party, not just, you know, anyone. And one final thing that I probably wanted to mention about what we think is going to happen in the next years is going to be like a lot more hostility in general, you know, against the organization of people, and more, probably more in LGBTI groups, which up to this point we have seen, but probably, let's say, not as much as other, for example, groups that have been, that are organized. For example, worker unions have been like directly detained and have been directly raided. And we have not seen that LGBTI, let's say, groups right now, but we foreseen that that could happen in the future, because right now the government is just going after any group that is, you know, criticizing the human rights violation that occurs in general in the country.
Yeah, I don't want to get too much into the whole fake news thing because I feel like we could do just a 3-hour conversation on that alone and how it affects politics in El Salvador, because you just mentioned YouTube. There are way too many people, especially as it pertains to El Salvador, that have no business calling themselves journalists or reporters who are spewing all sorts of things, including things that target the LGBTQ community in El Salvador. It wasn't always this way, though. I mean, as recently as 2018, there was sort of a brief moment before Bukele came into office where it seemed like the country was going to do more to protect or at the very least acknowledge LGBTQ rights in El Salvador. So, for example, I think you guys will remember in 2018, the National Palace in the capital, San Salvador, was lit up in the rainbow colors during Pride Month almost 6 years ago. But that moment was fleeting. And in hindsight, leads us to ask about the challenges faced before Bukele took into office. So Roberto, you know, gave us a lot of information to process there. But Nicola, you know, going back to that time period, you know, in hindsight, tell us about the challenges that are not necessarily exclusive to Bukele, the administration, or even the individual when it comes to LGBTQ mm-hmm. rights.
Yeah, it's funny you should bring up this period. I was just talking to Dani, who was another one of the co-founders of Amate recently, about how we kind of, I feel like us and a few other different organizations kind of emerged at this zeitgeist that you're mentioning, right? That started with the Funes administration around like 2009, 2010, and ended with the end of Sánchez Serén's period, right? Which is 2019. When there was like all these gestures that, you know, as Roberto says, we're pretty imperfect. We like to complain about them a lot, but like all these like gestures and inclusion, you know, we had like for a while, a 24/7 hotline for LGBTQ people in government, you know, people were like facing discrimination or had questions about their rights or whatever, had all of these different like working agreements with the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Labor to encourage inclusion, you know, the thing that you were mentioning about like the National Palace being lit up, the Ministry of Health was like hoisting the pride flag during June, right?
Oh, in addition, even the Episcopal Church of El Salvador's diversity ministry took part in this, which gives people an idea of how things were 6 years ago to possibly having more rights for the LGBTQ community, which is, if you think about it, kind of astounding for a deeply Catholic country, correct?
Catholic and evangelical, I think, is important to highlight here, because that I feel like the big sort of, you know, what we're calling like anti-right pushes are happening here through like really fundamentalist evangelical churches that haven't been around all that long, comparatively speaking, you know, relative to the Catholic Church, like 30 years or something like that. Yeah, actually, I was just going through Amate's collections on the Secretary for Social Inclusion pretty recently and kind of looking at all of these materials that the government would put out to, you know, educate like correctional officers in prisons about like how to treat like trans people who are incarcerated and all this stuff that you just like just totally disappeared. So I think related to that, even though we had all of this stuff going for us, you know, quote unquote, there's still like incredibly high levels of transphobic violence, incredibly high levels of discrimination and unemployment and lack of inclusion more generally. I mean, Roberto's whole senior thesis was about, you know, the, you know, like astronomical rates of unemployment among trans folks in the San Salvador. I write country conditions reports for people's asylum cases. Like I have to pull up all of these like horrifying statistics and cases for like these like really gory, like anti-trans hate crimes. So, you know, despite all this visibility that we had 5 years ago, even the sort of day-to-day safety and access of everyday people was really limited. Like it's still like on the ground. It's like still a pretty difficult panorama for sure. A lot of misperceptions, a lot of religious-based sort of hatred and rechazo, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it is a lot of ugly stuff, which is why I wanted to highlight that brief moment in 2018, because while it didn't necessarily solve some of the issues or all of the issues that we're discussing here, the fact that the government and even religious organizations recognize Pride Month in that one fleeting moment was something that, at the very least, you know, gives importance to an organization like Amate for the historical memory and also what is capable in a very evangelical country, as Nicola just mentioned, of trying to achieve some degree or some measure of recognition in a deeply religious country. And so this is precisely why we want to have you guys on the show today. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with both Nicola Chavez and Roberto Zapata. They are both members of AMATE of El Salvador. And this is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
De mi tierra es El Salvador, la llevo en la sangre con mucho sabor, la llevo en la sangre con mucho sabor, y su melodía de felicidad llena de alegría todo El Salvador, llena de alegría todo El Salvador. De mi tierra, cumbia de mi bailar, la tristeza que llevo en el alma, con tu ritmo yo puedo olvidar.
Cumbia de mi tierra, es El Salvador,
la llevo en la sangre, con mucho sabor, la llevo en la sangre, con mucho sabor.
Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can follow us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about the challenges of LGBTQ rights under the Bukele administration in El Salvador with Nicola Chavez and Roberto Zapata, who are both members of AMATE of El Salvador. So, Nicola, I want to ask you, as recently as this year, Nayib Bukele took a direct shot at the LGBTQ community when he decided to attack gender theory and that it shouldn't be included in the public education system in El Salvador. It was a decision made in late February that seems almost identical to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's attack on Black queer theory in his state's public education system almost a year ago. And so I'll direct this question to Roberto as well, but I wonder if both of you can tell us about the response from both LGBTQ activists as well as from feminist groups in El Salvador about this decision. And as you guys pointed out already, there have been a lot of decisions that have been detrimental to LGBTQ rights in El Salvador. This one is perhaps the most recent, and because the erasure of memory is such an underlying issue of this administration, carries with it more importance.
I think it's important to highlight how the context in which all of this came about. So, you know, one, Bukele made this announcement about the elimination of gender ideology in the public educational system, as well as in the Ministry of Health, on the same day that Milei in Argentina said the exact same thing and went about going the exact same way. So it's very clear that these people are working hand in hand. And it's like such a part of like a broader alt-right push in governance in Latin America, right? Like, I think that's really important to highlight. And also this kind of authoritarian, really personality, messianic based style of doing politics. Like, this wasn't a decree. This wasn't like a codified set of rules. This was a tweet that was then shared within various ministries. There's no formal protocol. It's really hazy. It's truly just a dog whistle to kind of signal to these hardline right-wing sectors that we will do everything to crush queer and trans people in order to make you feel like this is a Christian heterosexual nation, right? So basically, like, what this means was super up to interpretation and just totally up to the individual whims of supervisors and people in government as to what, you know, eliminating gender ideology would look like. So in the public school system, what this means is not a whole heck of a lot. Like, it's been a longstanding feminist struggle to try to incorporate comprehensive sex ed into the Salvadoran curriculum for decades, right? You know, this is, abortion is totally illegal under all circumstances. Condoms are way more expensive than they need to be for, you know, people's income levels here. They're not super readily accessible or available. This is, as you mentioned, a very Catholic, a very evangelical country. So we don't talk about even the mechanisms by which people get pregnant. So if all that stuff is not even in the curriculum to begin with, I'm like, what stuff referencing LGBTQ people is even in the public educational system to begin with? Like, I feel like towards the end of the FMLN governments, we were starting to try and push for maybe the discussion of, okay, you know, when you're starting to understand your sexuality, perhaps you won't just be attracted to the opposite sex, just like really tiny little things in the curriculum that, you know, obviously didn't make any waves or anything like that. But I'm just saying that's absent to begin with. So I feel like in that aspect, it was a pretty meaningless decree that was just mostly meant to kind of garner support. But in regards to what it meant for the Ministry of Health, that this is the more sinister part. Because HIV has been in the country since 1984. It came in during the Salvadoran Civil War, so not a whole lot of attention to it was paid during that time period for really obvious reasons. There was no comprehensive law or anything to sort of address the effects of HIV/AIDS in regards to access to medication or non-discrimination, which was a really big one for access to medication, da da da. Until 2001. So it's a long time, right? So the HIV/AIDS pandemic was actually like a really serious thing here for quite a while. And part of these contention efforts, these anti-pandemic, you know, reduction efforts involved like, you know, segregating data, right? And making sure that we had a sense of, okay, like what kind of populations are most at risk? What kind of populations is this virus spreading in, right? And so now the Ministry of Health doesn't have any of that information on its intake forms. Like, we have absolutely no sense of like, is the virus now more prevalent among men who have sex with men, among trans women, among cis women, sex workers? Like, that's the really scary part, is the fact that now we can't talk about quote unquote gender ideology in the places where it matters, such as where people are trying to get access to basic healthcare. So even from an individual perspective, that's really wrong. But also just from a general epidemiological perspective, it's really concerning. And, you know, kind of goes hand in hand with the management of the COVID-19 pandemic, in which a lot of figures were being hidden and tamped down. And we don't have really good figures on how the pandemic actually affected the country in terms of deaths and infection, because I, you know, a lot of that information, I think, was really messed with.
Well, yeah, that's a Pandora's box of health issues that may be coming down the road because of this sort of manipulation. Roberto, was there anything else you wanted to add to that?
Well, certainly, you know, as well, let's see this in perspective. The educational sector in El Salvador has been one of the more conservative ones and like one of the more hard to work with for the LGBTI organizations. And Nicola just talked about that. But one of the sectors that we thought, you know, did some like conquered territory that there's no way that we will, you know, going back is what, you know, health, because, you know, it's been a 20 years struggle to get to the point where we have, you know, forms with sexual orientation or gender identity questions so that we were able to see the evolution of the HIV pandemic in El Salvador. And now we just don't have that. And I think that for the majority of the LGBTI folks in El Salvador was one of them surprises, a very bad surprise. Because again, we thought that, that was something that it was not going to happen, and it did. And so this probably give us a dimension of the what is going on in El Salvador. Because for the government, they really don't care what they are going or they what they have to do if that gives them like more popularity. So even if it's going for the more or the most hateful or the most dangerous of actions, they are going to do it because, you know, it's more popularity for them. And that's very delicate to talk about the actual lives of people, because we have had like people living with HIV asking us, am I going to get my treatment this month? Or do you know anything about that? Because we have people like that are really scared about their future in terms of how am I going to access like very basic health? Because previously, and I'm not sure if you know about this, but there were like clinics, like specialized clinics in the whole healthcare system should work for the LGBTI people as for the rest of the people. But let's say that it's a safe place for the sexual diversity community to go there and access, you know, health. But now these clinics are still exist, but they don't have any visibility that they have been told that they cannot like speak loudly about what they do. And they change the forms, like I said, and that this is something that is already impacting very negatively the LGBTI population. One other thing that I want to mention about, you know, and more returning to the education sector is that, for example, we have a few cases registered where, for example, a trans teenager were able to go to the school, a public school, using the uniform, because, you know, in El Salvador, they use uniforms and they can use the uniform according to their gender identity and not what, you know, the system is saying. But this was like more isolated cases because, let's say, the director or the in that institution was more open and they allowed the teenager to go to classes like that. But now, after these declarations of President Bukele, we had some of these trans people told us that the directors told them that they shouldn't continue going to classes with their uniforms because that was probably gender ideology and that they were afraid that they didn't have a problem, but that they were afraid that, for example, if someone else, even if it's a parent or if it's another teacher, told the Ministry of Education, they were faced, you know, these directors would face retaliation because that's what the memorandum of the Ministry of Education said about this gender ideology prohibition.
That is a very fascinating story because it brings up something that I think doesn't get mentioned often enough, whether we're talking about LGBTQ rights in El Salvador or even in the United States. So if we go back to what we saw with all the anti-LGBTQ legislation in the United States, it really was, in the case of the story that you just mentioned, by attacking this vulnerable community, it is also an underhanded way of attacking the public education system. It's also an underhanded way of attacking the healthcare system by focusing on this one community, this very vulnerable community, whether it be in El Salvador or in the United States. And that parallel isn't drawn often enough, I think, as it should. And it's a good thing that organizations like yours are making that parallel and drawing that comparison as well. Because let's just face it, as Nicola mentioned, Bukele is playing politics here. And not only because I said or because she said, because Spanish magazines like El País, for example, made a point of it, because when he made that decree against gender theory in the public education system in El Salvador, it came around the same time after the Electoral Court of El Salvador settled the dispute over the election results and ratified the president's electoral victory, which, again, as we said before, is illegal under the Salvadoran constitution. And that decree was also around the same time in February when he went to CPAC here in the U.S. and made this conference, you know, spewing out all sorts of anti-Semitic, neoliberal nonsense, shall we say. So there's nothing wrong with saying that he's playing politics, but it's at the detriment of public education and public health along the way. So I'm glad that you guys are making that parallel. So as I mentioned in the introduction, and you guys kind of mentioned as well, that various right-wing luminaries like Donald Trump Jr., Tucker Carlson, were in attendance for Bukele's inauguration. In addition, Argentina's right-wing president Javier Milei was there. Costa Rica's evangelical president Rodrigo Chavez Robles was also there. Guatemala, right about this time last year, was having their presidential election, and a lot of right-wing candidates were discussing the quote-unquote Bukele model when it comes to governance. And that governance, quote unquote, clearly with this conversation also means attacks on the LGBTQ community in El Salvador. So my question to the both of you, considering the politics of the people I just mentioned, do you see parallels between Bukele's anti-LGBTQ actions with actions on reproductive rights along the way? Nicola?
I definitely do. So Bukele was first the mayor of San Salvador when he was with the FMLN party, which is really hard to believe at this point, but he was. And he was a progressive candidate, entre comillas, you know, like he was, you know, the ally more or less of the LGBTQ community. He started his own women's secretariat within town hall.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Which, of course, he hired his wife to lead. So this is, I'm trying to, you know, not let her off the hook either, right? She's a perinatal psychologist, and the two of them have been pushing these really strong kind of family first policies. So there's a couple of different new laws that have been put into place that are just like hammering down the focus on like early childhood and pregnancy. So one is La Ley Nacer Con Cariño, and the other one is the Ley Crecer Juntos. And so it's just like, the insidious part about the Nacer con Cariño law, which sounds really good and hopefully will, for at least some people, present an improvement for their birthing experiences in public institutions, right? Because it's notoriously really violent, under-resourced, really like poor quality services for birthing people. But it requires the intervention of health personnel, quote unquote, from the moment of conception. So if we all understand what the moment of conception is, that's literally during the sexual act itself, right? So basically what it's calling for is for state intervention and vigilance from the moment people are even thinking about having children. And that's terrifying in a country in which abortion is already illegal under any circumstance, even if the mother's life is in danger, even if the baby's life is not viable, right? Women go to prison for 30, 40 years for murder, for having had even miscarriages, right? So if you're thinking about the fact that they're, you know, their sort of pro-life policies are extending to that level of like reproductive choice without offering real reproductive choice at the same time, it gets really scary, right? It's like I said, it's not like we're increasing comprehensive sex ed. It's not like we're like increasing condom distribution. It's not like, you know, we're educating about different forms of contraception alongside this. We're just focusing on people giving birth and raising babies. It's a big, big thing. So I feel like that in conjunction with all this other stuff that's happening, like against the LGBTI community, is actually really scary when you think about it. It's like promoting a very particular kind of heterosexual nuclear family, which, by the way, isn't even like the norm for average Salvadoran societies. We have like half of all households here are headed by single mothers, right? It's kind of a fantasy if we're thinking about like, this is really like how the nation presents itself. But all of these really draconian measures are being pushed through as like, we are defending the Salvadoran moral order. And they really keep using those words over and over again. And you kind of have to wonder, like, order for who, for which Salvadorans, right? It's a little disturbing.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I guess it's like two sides of this. Like one, the symbolic, which is everything that Ecola just spoke about. And at the same time, or one thing that we probably haven't mentioned as much and is very important, and it's probably going to get worse in the years that are coming, is the influence of the anti-gender groups that have, you know, garnered in the previous years. And one of the main examples that I usually put on, you know, on the table are, for example, we are currently living in times where when there is a project, a law coming from the government to the legislative assembly, they don't change anything. Like, they approve exactly what they are given. And we had this law that was coming from the office of the first lady. And it was, you know, that the project of the law. And it had like two articles that spoke about non-discrimination and included like sexual orientation and gender identity as a, you know, non-viable reason to discriminate, you know, against a child or a teenager. And when this law came to the legislative assembly, anti-gender groups made a press conference and spoke against the law because it included those terms. And they said that the government was, you know, approaching or was working for the LGBTI community, and that that was, you know, again, the norms of the country or the cultural background and traditions and stuff like that. And after that, like the next day, the legislative assembly approved the law, but they had eliminated these two terms of the project. So it was like one of the few examples where we have seen the legislative assembly doing or changing something of a project that has come from the, you know, the government. So that's a big thing. Like I said, usually projects don't see change at all. And these groups were able to pressure the legislative assembly to do it. And also we have seen, for example, in last June, that for the first time in, you know, 25 years of the march, we have seen a group of people protesting against the Pride March. And they were there, and there were people, like a couple of people, you know, white people that you could see that they were not from the El Salvador. And because there were certain signs, they were, you know, holding signs in English as well.
Oh, really?
And certain people like from the march approached to these people and spoke to them, you know, in English. And they started responding because they were obviously not people from El Salvador. And they were like, you know, using dresses as priests. So it was like an evangelical group, obviously financed through, you know, money coming from the US. And it was like a small group, let's say, probably, I don't know, 30 people, something like that. But it was like they had this logistic, you know, of taking these people from, I don't know where place in El Salvador, probably a small evangelical church, and then in using a bus, taking them to the El Salvador del Mundo, and then waiting for the march to get there. And they started, you know, protesting with their signs. And I talked to like activists that were like since the first Pride March, and they said that they have never seen something like that. Obviously, you always get like people, you know, that are going through the streets, passing by, you know, yelling things at you. But that's an actual action that was planned and that was financed through someone, a group of people against the LGBTI movement. So I thought that that was very symbolic as well. And probably for this year, we will see something like that or even bigger.
We're just about out of time, but that's an amazing story. And just another reason why we got to have Roberto and Nicola back on the show. You just left us with a cliffhanger here because I had not heard about that story. And I definitely want to learn more about this as it develops. But in the meantime, we've been speaking with Nicola Chavez, who's the head of historical memory for AMATE in El Salvador. Roberto Zapata is also a member of AMATE of El Salvador. And before we conclude, I just want to give a shout out to Yesenia Portillo from CISPES, who helped organize this fantastic conversation. But in the meantime, Roberto Zapata, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
And Nicola Chavez, thank you very much for being on the show with us as well.
Thank you so much for having us today.
You got it. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone to follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. You can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. And of course, we're live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
June is Caribbean American Heritage Month. That's CAWI, CPN, ICS, AFI and Africa World Now Project present the 22nd DC Caribbean Film Fest June 7th to the 12th at AFI Silver Theater and Culture Center in downtown Silver Spring. The festival showcases the best in Caribbean cinema with 15 films representing 10 Caribbean countries. Highlights include discussions with filmmakers and Caribbean refreshments. The DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 7th to the 12th, scheduled at afi.com/silver or 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This Saturday, June 8th at noon, people are gathering from around the country to surround the White House, demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, an end to the siege, freedom of all Palestinian prisoners, and an end to the occupation of Palestine. June 8th marks 8 months of U.S.-Israeli genocide of the Palestinian people and 54 years since the occupation of Gaza. A month ago, President Biden said that the invasion of Rafah was a red line, but now the invasion of Rafah has continued for weeks and has expanded to the entire Gaza Strip. The June 8th rally will create a people's red line around the White House. That's June 8th, noon, at the White House. More information is at shutitdownforpalestine.org. That's shut...
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bengert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. A U.S.-built pier on the Gaza coast that had been damaged by rough seas has been reconnected to the beach and is expected to resume taking in food and other supplies soon. A U.S. Central Command spokesperson announced the pier reattachment this morning and said aid flows would resume, quote, in the coming days. The spokesperson also said the U.S. expects to resume airdropping aid soon. Even before the pier broke apart in late May, the delivery of aid was hampered by weather issues, personnel problems, and a lack of fuel to transport the aid inland. The U.S. spokesperson said the goal is to transport about 500 tons of supplies through the pier every 2 days, about half the total aid delivered before the pier broke apart. Overnight Israeli strikes in central and southern Gaza killed 23 Palestinians as tanks continued their westward push through the city of Rafah. An Israeli airstrike on a school in central Gaza killed at least 33 people yesterday morning, including 12 women and children. Israel claimed to be targeting Hamas members they say were operating from within the school. Local health officials and witnesses say the school was housing displaced Palestinians and was being run by the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA. That agency's director said on social media that 6,000 people were sheltering in the school when it was hit, and said claims of a militant presence were unverified. U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller called on Israel to be transparent about the strike and to release the names of militants they believe they've killed. On Wednesday, Israel announced a new ground and air operation in central Gaza to root out militants they say have regrouped there. The UN Migration Agency warned today that the number of internally displaced people in Sudan could soon exceed 10 million. Fighting has raged across Sudan since last April, consuming the capital Khartoum and reigniting ethnic violence in the western Darfur region. The UN Migration Agency said there were 9.9 million internally displaced people across Sudan as of this week, up from 2.8 million before the war. More than 2 million people have fled Sudan altogether into Egypt, Chad, Ethiopia, and other neighboring countries. A quarter of the internally displaced people are children under the age of 5. The UN has also warned that Sudan is at imminent risk of famine, with about 3.6 million acutely malnourished children. European Union parliamentary elections began yesterday in the Netherlands and will last the next 3 days as hundreds of millions of people across 27 member states cast ballots in an election expected to boost the far right. Geert Wilders of Netherlands' far-right Party for Freedom was one of the first politicians to cast a ballot in the contest. Wilders, along with populist conservative forces in France, Germany, Italy, and elsewhere, seek to strictly limit immigration into the EU and return power away from EU central institutions back to national governments. Preliminary results in the Netherlands show left-wing parties narrowly winning a majority of votes, but with a significant gain in support for Wilders' party. Ireland and the Czech Republic will hold their EU elections today, and the remaining countries will hold elections over the weekend. Results will be announced Sunday night. And in domestic news, high temperature records were broken across the U.S. Southwest yesterday, and the region's first heat wave of the year is expected to last at least another day. Large portions of Arizona and Nevada are under